Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank these beautiful four women who are up here to introduce me, horny, angry, lonely, and tired. Now that you're done trolling for 20 years, we can get into AA here. I feel good now. I've been wandering around here for 4 days, just wild. I felt like a cat locked in a garage all damn night, you know. And then you finally open it, and you know, like that. And it was like that ever since we landed in Newark, you know, and then came down here. And Newark makes me glad I'm from L.A. And I'm glad to be here. These ladies look familiar, somewhat. Well, they all do, but these particular four ladies look familiar. I was at the little pharmacy they have in here, a little drugstore they got in there, and I went in there, and I wanted to get a little jar of Vaseline. And there was about five people by the cash register, and it was my turn. And so I asked the lady, I said, "Do you have any Vaseline?" And she says, "Yes, we do." She says, "What are you going to use it for?" I never had so much damn attention. I mean, they were all just, you know. And, I mean, anything you would have said, oh, you know. and I said, "Well, there's a couple spots that I need to use that on every now and then." She goes, "Oh," I said, "Why are you asking me this?" And she says, "Well, because if you just needed it for your lips, we have chapstick. But," she says, "being since you're going to use it all over," she says, "we'll give you the jar," you know. And I said, "I didn't say I was going to use it all over, you know, but I might. I don't know, you know." And these ladies were just looking on. It was just so weird. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. I'm living proof, my sponsor says, that a man can stay sober for a little over 13 years and not amount to a damn thing. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I guarantee you that. What will I say? Well, yeah, I've been in and out of this damn room for 6 months, you know. But I love being sober. I'm happy to be sober. And are there any new people here under 30 days? I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I welcome you. And I hope that you never have to feel the way you feel today. I hope you never have to return to what got you here. I hope I never, never forget what it was like before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and how I sat in these rooms for years after years thinking that just sitting in meetings was the answer. I hope I never forget that. If sitting in rooms talking about neat things was the answer, this place would be packed. And I just hope you're at that place where you're willing to do something about your life, you know. I've got a good life today. I have a great life today. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time these days making fun of AA and it ain't quite right or it's too different and they seem to be putting down sobriety. And I hope I never have to live the way I used to do. I hope I never forget what it was like out there. Drunk or sober, I hope I never forgot what it was like because I'm here because my way don't work. Drunk or sober, in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, my way don't work. I'm living proof of that. You know? And I've got the good life today. I've got the good life today. I mean, Florida? What the hell am I doing in Florida? You know, I mean, I have no idea. And I've got the good life today. Just to talk about the thing that I love. Just to talk about the thing that I love and that we love. You know, and just going in and out of these damn elevators all weekend. You know, I mean, I'm what the Alcoholics Anonymous book tells me that in his best moments he produces confusion. I mean, this elevator here, you know, there's something about elevators. It's just quiet, you know. I mean, I would have loved to have heard some of that dentist office music, you know, but it's just quiet there, you know. And it reminds me of this story when I was a couple years sober. It has to do with an elevator. I was doing some construction in downtown Los Angeles, and we were gonna demolish this old hotel, the Dunbar Hotel off of 60th and Central. It was an old jazz hotel. All the jazz greats used to stay there. And we were gonna demo it and turn it into a seniors home. And so there had been some gang banging going around there, and some guy got shot or something like that. And so the construction foreman got together with the security guards and stuff like that. They said, let's get these guys in here at 4:30 and get them out of the neighborhood by 2:30. And they'll say, that's great. So that following Monday, I go into the job site, and just like this hotel, it just, you know, a bunch of construction stuff going on, you know, but it was pitch dark. Pitch dark, and it's 4:30, and you're stepping over lumber and stuff like that, you know, and I get to the elevator, you know, and the elevator door opens up, and there's these two guys in there. I get into the elevator, and the elevator closes. You know, and the guy says behind me, I hear this, hit the floor. I look behind me, and the guy says, hit the floor. Oh, man, I get down there, and I'm laying on the damn floor, and I start shaking. I think about what my first sponsor said, what goes around comes around, you know. You know, and I got $3, and I'm the cookie lady of my meeting, and if they take that, I'm going to kill it. You know, all kinds of crazy stuff going on, you know. Anyway, I'm still down there shaking like some goof, you know, and the elevator stops, and it opens up, and these two guys walk right by me. And I go, what the hell is that all about, man? Come time for to get lunch, you know, I go to the Roach Coach, you know, and I go to pay for my little coffee and stuff like that. And the guy says, oh, no, hold it there. He says, you don't have to pay for nothing. I says, what? He says, you don't have to pay for nothing as long as you live here. He says, you see those two guys back there? I said, yeah. He says, they never laughed so hard their whole damn life. They said they when you got in the elevator, they worked for the elevator company. They were testing the cables of the elevator, and they wanted you to hit the floor button. I said, what the hell is this all about? I tell you, if there's anything about... anything I hated growing up was public humility, you know. I hated being, you know, I can do that well myself, damn it, you know, and I just hated that. And I had a good mom and dad. My mom and dad aren't the reason I am AA. They didn't sabotage me into drinking. I didn't have such a rotten life that we ought to be on Oprah and I ought to sue them, you know, or nothing like that, you know. If my folks would have drove me to drink, I would have thanked them. God, thank you, my God, you know. They didn't drive me to drink. They were just folks. I come from a long line of goofs, from Michigan to California, just a goof, 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 you know. Just a goofy family, man, just goofism, you know. And my mom was a Scandinavian lady, and she loved diet pills. My mom loved that speed. She was always eating those green and white Dexies and buzzing around the damn neighborhood, you know. And I always mowing the yard around 10 at night, you know, It would be nothing to come home from school and see old mom wrestling a refrigerator by herself because she wants to wax the floor. You know, she's going to get, you know, I found out at an early age that if I ever wanted any love or affection, I could find mom around 5 a.m. sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage, you know, or something, you know, just a nutty lady, you know, she loved to needlepoint. Mom was always making those damn Afghans, you know, always clicking and clacking, you know, everything in that house had a cover for it, you know. My dad's wine bottles, you know, had covers, little dogs, you know. His golf clubs, he had the chipmunks on the golf clubs, you know. Toilet paper was in a cover, you know. She had the toilet paper in this little pink doll with these big button eyes and hair, you know. Like you're going to turn around and talk to it, you know. I think it's a 5-sheet night, you know. I mean, what the hell are you going to say to it, you know? I know she was talking to it, you know, and she was always clicking and clacking, and she loved to do those damn puzzles, man. She loved to get loaded on those Dexies and go to Thrifty's, you know, and get those jigsaw puzzles and a package and a carton of Viceroy's. Come home, you know, and get that old card table out, you know, and man, she's going to do that puzzle, you know. And she's all buzz, you know, and she had a big pair of toenail clippers. So that piece that didn't fit, well, by golly, she'd clip that son of a bitch. And... here. And she was always hanging that shit in my room, you know. I had the picture of the Mojave Desert, you know, and Vermont, you know, things I really want to look at, you know. And she was proud, man. She was proud of that stuff, you know. And she got a hold of a power edger one night. And she just took off down the damn block for 2 hours, man. Just nothing but eyes and sparks, man. She just took off. And she came back, and she was, and the diet was working hell. She was down to a stick. There was nothing but eyes, and she 50 pounds, you know, blonde hair, and just nutty as a... And she was always out in the garage. My mom was always farting around in the damn garage, you know. And she used to get my dad's bolts and screws and nails and put them in little Gerber baby jars, you know. And then put the lids on a little piece of wood so he can twirl them around and find them, you know. The old man never spent a day out there, okay. I never seen him in the garage. He had no business in the garage. He knew who was out in the garage, you know. He knew what was out there, you know. And it was Mom. Mom was out there. And she was a neat lady. I love my mom. She loved me to death, man. And my dad was a refinery worker, and he was always coming home at different weeks. Every week he was coming home at a different hour. And my dad was a happy singing the Mills Brothers Nat King Cole drunk. Boy, he'd drink that cheap wine and just sing those Bobby Darin songs, you know. He loved to sing Mack the Knife. Oh, that shock. I mean, you know, about 4 a.m, the old man's singing these tunes, you know. And dad was a window climber. Dad was always sneaking in and out of his own damn house, you know. And Jesus Christ, you know, what the hell are you gonna do, you know? You roll over and dad's halfway in the damn window, you know? And he's either coming in or out of his own house, you know, and you wonder why your father don't have keys to his own home, you know? What the hell's going on, Dad, you know? He snuck in there one night, you know, I could feel that old refinery boot on my chest, you know? And Dad snuck in there, you know, and I just, oh man, I said, Jesus Christ, Dad, I said, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, man? Hell, she's up anyway, I mean, you know, she's up... She'll eat enough of that speed and make you one with her teeth, you know. Just, and I'm sure she'll knit you a key ring to go with it, you know. And get the hell out of my room, though. So he moved me out of my room, and he took me down the hall, and I started sleeping with my grandfather. Now, there was a piece of work. Gramps always told me that I look better than both my sisters. That'll make you feel like a champ, you know. And you're going to be sleeping with Grandpa, all right, you know, and there's going to be no York and Borkin tonight, Grandpa, you know, and you learn to sleep with one eye open, you know, and you're watching Grandpa like a hawk, you know, and he was a frustrated Catholic, and he was always doing his rosary around midnight. You'd be ready to turn in, and all of a sudden you'd hear this, oh, man, what the hell's he going to, now he's going to do that all night, you know, and he'd jiggle the beads, and then there'd be silence, and then Gramps would get up, and he'd go over to his sock drawer, open up that sock drawer, then you hear this. Alkies know what that sound is, all right? I don't care where I go. Al-Anons think that that's a cricket, okay? Alkies know, man. Alkies know what that sound is, man. And he capped the seal off of that peach brandy and threw it back, and then he'd come back to bed, you know, and there'd be a little bit of silence, and then you'd hear this. I look, oh God, what's he doing now, you know? And I look over there, you know, and Gramps is sanding his bunions down, all right? I want to hang that old Swede with his own rosary right then, you know? And I'm, you know, where in the hell can a kid get some sleep, you know? Mom's up all night mowing the neighborhood. Dad's stuck in a window, and Grandpa's over here rubbing himself raw all night, you know? And I want to get some sleep, man. I've always wanted a good night's sleep. I want one tonight. I want a good night's sleep, you know? I don't care how much Vaseline it takes. I want a good night's sleep. God damn it, you know. I want a good night's sleep tonight, man. And I'm glad Gloria's with me. I love little Gloria. I love her to death, man. She's a slapper. She's a biter. She's a pincher. She's a yeller. She's a screamer. And besides those sexual qualities, I love her. I love her to death. I love her to death, man. And so there I am, man, and I'm getting frustrated, and I can't sleep, so I go out on the living room couch, man, and I start getting in my old man's Thunderbird, you know, and I start watching those old shows, The Honeymooners and Sky King and The Cisco Kid, and just watching those old shows, you know, and I was just a kid. I was just a goofy kid, you know. I was just I was just doing all the other stuff kind of kid, you know. I wasn't hidden in a closet, and I wasn't, you know, anything other than just a goofy kid. I always loved getting into trouble. It fascinated me just to do it, you know. And I've never been satisfied with everyday living. It's never been enough for me. And I've always been fascinated at why everybody else can do it and make it look easy. And I've always wanted to do that because I've always known that what I'm feeling isn't the answer. I've always known that just this isn't it. There's got to be more than this. I've always questioned how I felt. And I've always known that I'm always going to need something else, man. Come around 10 years old, my dad comes down to my bedroom, And he tells me that I'm going to have a baby brother. And this Alky starts planning for his kid brother, man. I start saving up my baseball cards and oiling up my glove and thinking about that kid brother. You know, and I start thinking about him, how me and him are going to go to the drag races and go to the football games. 9 months later, my dad comes down to that same bedroom and he tells me that my baby brother died. I don't remember ever having any ounce of compassion. I don't remember having any thought like, is there anything I can do for my mom? Is there anything I could say? But what I did do was something that it comes to me and it's with me today. It's with me this very moment. How we go right through temper tantrum into rage in a New York second. And with 90, 80 pounds of my little goofy body, I went after my old man. And for the first time in my life, I made physical contact with my father. And it wasn't a handshake. I went after him with every little ounce of anger I had. And I started slugging him and yelling at him. And I went into that orange rage that we go to. And I can't see around me. I'm tunneled in. I can't hear nothing. And I'm attacking. And the only thing that I'm saying to that man is, you promised me. You promised me, Dad. You promised me a little brother. And that man was going to be on top of my amends list when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't a list of drunken behavior. It wasn't a list of 502s. It was stuff like that. Little nickel and dime stuff like that that drove this alcoholic to Alcoholics Anonymous with a hole in him like that. That you could drive if you want to get to the beach tonight. You could drive right through it. It was so big. And the little nickel and dime things that I would stuff and stuff and stuff and I couldn't forget. But they would always pop up when I was sober. And I went after that old man. And that was the last brick in a wall that was ever going to come between me and my... I was building a wall for years, and I don't know why. But that was the last brick in that wall, and whatever family said, you can have it. If that's family, if that's love, if that's unity, I don't want no part about it. And I started running those streets at an early age. I started running the streets because I felt more a part of life under the streets at midnight than I did around my own dinner table with my family. I don't know why. But around 11 years old, I'm across the street, and they start, me and about three other guys, and they start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I took a shot of that stuff, and it went down in me, like everybody says, and it filled me up. And for the first time in my life, man, I felt normal. For the first time in my life, man, the click was on, and no matter who I was or what I was doing, it was all right today. Man, I was all right today. As goofy and as weak and as weird as I thought, man, everything was just right. And it was just right every time I took a drink, man. I never needed a reason to drink. I drank for no reason at all. I drank because of the way that I felt when I was sober, man. And then I puked. But I'll never forget that connection that I made with happiness that day. That connection that I've always been able to make myself feel better. I've always been able to feel good. And it's always been done by me putting something into my system. But I've never been able to be happy. God, I've never been able to be happy. And there's a big difference. There was a big difference. I knew nothing about being happy when I come to you. And man, and I pursued alcohol, and every time I pursued alcohol, it did what I expected it to do. It did for me what I couldn't do for myself every time, man. And come time to get into high school, I didn't have a group to hang around with, and I didn't know who I was going to hang around with, and I wanted to be a part of a group, and I wasn't smart enough to be an educated guy, and I wasn't big enough to be a football player, and I didn't know who I was going to hang around with. And I found a group of people that made me feel more a part of life than the people did in Alcoholics Anonymous at first. And it was the lowriders. And I love the lowriders. And I don't know if you have them out here. I've seen a couple trucks that were lowered. But over on the West Coast, we get our Chevrolets and we lower them down to the ground about like this. And we get our hair up real high. And we bounce around and we listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck about 2 months ago and the Four Tops came on and I start sinking in my damn plumbing truck, man. I'm right there, man. And we'd spend, just like these kids are doing today, man, you spend all day driving up and down the street. I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she used to curl her hair up real big. She used these old soup cans to curl her hair up, you know, and sometimes that old soup was still in them, you know, and she'd curl up her hair real big and get her eyebrows painted up, and my hair looked like a Kansas City tumbleweed, man. I get that thing real up like that, and I get these white t-shirts with these black khaki pants that came up to here and these pointed shoes that were like that, and you could see me in my hair before I turned the damn corner, man, you know. And I loved it. We'd spend all day in that car, man, just bouncing up and down, and everything I wanted in life was in that Chevrolet. Everything I wanted in life was in that Chevrolet, and I loved the way I felt, man. And you guys have a lot of hamburger places out here, and McDonald's and stuff like that. I don't know if you have the Jack in the Box out here. But back there in the West Coast, we have this thing called a Jack in the Box restaurant, where you drive up and you talk to this clown, and you put in your order. And it was a driver education class where they teach you how to drive. I think you're like 15 or 16, like you've never driven before. And so it was my turn to drive, and the instructor says, get into the car, you know, get into the car, Thomas, it's your turn. So I get into the car, I get my hair into the damn car like that, you know, and we drive around, and he wants me to parallel park, so I parallel park. And there's three other people in the back of the car, and he says, you know what? He says, you're doing pretty good. Let's go to the Jack in the Box. I want to buy everybody some Pepsi. And I said, great idea, man. And we pull into this Pepsi, and what I totally forgot was that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. And these things are great, man. These things are beautiful. They're half Seconal and half Amitol. You know, you're knocked out and you're telling the truth. You know, I mean, yeah, that's bad for an alky. That's bad for an alky, you know. You know, well, last night I was over at Debbie's house. You know, I mean, that was bad, you know. And I took four of these things, and I'd been a good kid. I'd just been doing heroin and drinking wine up to that point. And this guy lays me on the four of these, and I don't know what they are, so I take them all, you know. I mean, what if they're no good? You take them all, you know. And you don't want to get caught with anything, so you take them all, you know. And there's only four, so what the hell? How good can they be, you know? So I took these things, and they're like a pitcher of martinis in a capsule, man. They're excellent. And so I didn't feel anything in 10 minutes, so I had nothing. They're bunk, you know, and you pull into the Jack in the Box, and sure enough, we pull into the Jack in the Box, and boom, these things nail me, man. And I'm sweating, and my ears are ringing, you know, and I can't see the coach, and he's a huge man, you know. I can't see the coach, and I turn to him to ask him what I should order, you know, and it comes out like, you know, I lost my voice. I can't see the guy. I can't, you know, can't talk anymore. And so I start listening for that, can I have your order, please, you know. And so I start honing in on that, you know. Can I have your order, please? And there's the menu. So I drive over, and the coach says, pull up there and talk to the puppet. You know, well, I can't see the puppet, you know. All I can hear is, can I have your order, please, you know. So I drive up into that puppet, and I overshoot the mark, and I hear this bam, and I run over the puppet. And I see this puppet's head hanging down like that. And I want to talk to the puppet, and all he's saying is, can I have your order, please, you know. And I want to talk to him, you know. I want him to come out and be my designated driver, I think, you know. And come on out of there, puppet. And anyway, the police come and they arrest me and they throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the damn parking lot. And they take me to jail and all that, and I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal, man, because big deal, you don't drive till you're 30. Now I'm on the best seat in the car. I'm riding shotgun. I'm calling the shots. And I discover the second most important thing to this alcoholic besides alcohol, it was the mirror. Boy, you want to keep an alky in a room? Put a mirror in there. Put a damn mirror in there, man. That's why they have those mirrors in the bars, man. Those people are glued, man. They say, oh, my God, look at you, man. You're on your fourth Boilermaker, and are you looking good, man? You are looking fine, man. Jesus Christ, man. Oh, my God, are you going to get them tonight, man? Look at you. And I caught a shot of myself in that rearview mirror, man. I'm bouncing around, and I'm taking a shot off of that white Muscatel, man. I'm taking, oh, my God, look at you, man. Every drink I took, my hair got bigger and my eyes got bluer. And I said, my God, are you going to get them tonight, man? You are going to get them tonight, man. And I start feeling real strong and muscular. And I take a look at myself in that mirror. And I put my little puny arm down and press it against the side of the car door to make it look big so you don't mess with me. You know what I mean? And God, I just loved it, man. And I don't know about you, but when I start drinking, I want to dance. I take a shot of whiskey, I want to grab a Mexican and start dancing, man. You know, I do. And, man, I take a shot of that stuff, man, and, oh, man, are you going to get them tonight, man? Look at you. You're 110 pounds. You can't lick a stamp, you know. You got 10 pounds of barf on your T-shirt, and you're feeling romantic, you know. Let's go dancing, man. You got all that sleep in your eyes, and your hair's going over that way, and I want you, you know. And I loved it, man. I loved the way it made me feel. And come around 1969, they start shipping everybody off to Vietnam, and they start shipping my buddies off to different places, and some of them are turning hippie and going up north and stuff like that. And, well, what am I going to do with my life, you know? So I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to Detroit. And I wound up in Phoenix. And they've got real cowboys and Indians in Phoenix, you know. I mean, what am I doing in Phoenix, you know? And kind of like I felt in Newark. And what's going on here, you know? And I started drinking that Old Crow whiskey, and I started writing prescriptions. I started drinking that Old Crow whiskey, and I started writing prescriptions and selling them, and ran a lot of them down south in Arizona and Tucson and stuff. And I started writing prescriptions for Seconal and Tylenol and Nembutal and Obertral and you name it all. I wrote it all, man. I guess, yeah, 2,000 of these, you know. And we had a good deal going down there, and so good they caught us at me in about a year, and they put me away for 2 years in southern Arizona for 2 years down there in an institution. And I come out of there in 1972 at the age of 21 years old, bound and determined that whatever happened to me was because I was hanging around those guys. That whatever happened to me, you can chalk it off to being a teenager. that whatever happened to me, you can chalk it off with being a gang member. You can, whatever happened to me, you can chalk it off to what it used to be like. Now I'm 21, man, and things are gonna start happening. And I got two voices in my head. I've always had voices in my head. I got a ton of them now, you know, but at least I can put faces to them. I had two prominent voices right then. I had my dad's voice telling me, you know, what are you gonna do with your life, you punk? When are you gonna grow up and have a life and do something and have a family and get a job? You're always gonna hang around those guys, Larry, and you're always gonna be a punk. And what do you do when people are right? Well, we've got a little shelf here. We have a bit of shelf and we put the people we hate on it, and the old man's right up there. My mom's on the other end of my ear, man, and I hear my mom's voice, Larry, you're always gonna be a loser. Why don't you stop running around those guys? You're always gonna be a loser. You're never gonna amount to nothing. And she's right. And she's up there with the old man. And the two most important people in my life, I know, hate me, and I hate them. But something else is happening to me, which is why I'm in this room right now. At the age of 21, and you'll hear it in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new, you'll hear it said in these clubs several different ways. There'll be a herd of people over here saying that they used to have a life, they started drinking, it got bad, and they come to AA. And then there'll be another herd over here who said they used to have a life, it started drinking, it got bad, then it stopped working, and they come to AA. At the age of 21 years old, it stopped working. I did not come to AA. That was not my first thought. Oh, crap, I better get to AA, you know. That was, now for the first time in my life, I'm concerned about my drinking. It's gotten my attention because that magic that was magic that you used to get with just every time you picked it up ain't working no more. My answer is not an answer no more. I can't find that little moment of peace. Not a weekend of peace. Not 4 days of peace. I can't find that little bit of peace that I've been shooting for that my head's been telling me all my life. It's the next one that'll bring it. The book talks about that physical elderly with the obsession of the mind. How you're physically beat and your mind's telling you it's the next one. And you got that conflict going on. I didn't know nothing about a phenomenon of craving. I knew nothing about that. My total life has been a con of me into my first drink. And the total destruction of my life has been my pursuit of the second one. Heaven forbid anybody that gets in the way of an alcoholic in his second drink, because he's going to get it. I don't care if you're 6 or you're 60, he's going through you and he's going to get it. No matter what the consequences, no matter his physical condition, and he don't even know it at the time, but he's got to get it. He's in something that's called a phenomenon of craving that they've been never been an answer to. And I didn't know that. I had no idea that was going on with me. I only drank, every time I drank, I was sober. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. And when I was sober, I felt that I was just a miserable little man with these little fears and stuff like that, and knowing that I'll never amount to nothing. And my mind was always, it was like an engine. Man, and I try to stay busy during the day, and it was always back there, man, like a piston in an engine, man. And sometimes you drink just to quiet it down. It's there! And it'll work for about 2 minutes. And then drink, and it starts right up, and you're with it constantly, day and night, man. And how in the hell you explain that to your teacher? You know, who you tell that to? That's the alky's secret. The important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say all the time, was remember your first drunk. Remember your first drink. I tell you what was something more important that following day after my first drunk was the secret knowledge that sobriety would never be enough. I knew from that point on I'd have to have something. And I couldn't dare tell anybody that. I couldn't dare mutter that to anybody. But after that first drunk and what it did for me, I had that secret knowledge that I'd always have to have this. I knew I'd never be able to do life without a shot. A shot of something. Cheap, expensive, I don't care what the heck it is. I don't care if you clean your nails with it or what. I'm going to have it, you know. And that's what was going through my mind at the age of 21 years old in 1972. It had stopped working. And I tried every imaginable combination to get it to work again, because when I was sober, my mind would say, remember what happened to you when you were 12? Remember how it used to work in the backseat of that Chevrolet? Remember how it used to work when you were in that garage? It's got to work. It worked once, it's got to work again. And in 1974, I'm over in California, and my probation officer doesn't know what to do with me. He's tried every imaginable remedy. Everything that he's tried on you guys, the anabuse, the counseling, the heart talks, all the goofy things he has you read and stuff like that, and he doesn't understand what the heck's going on with you. And so he puts me in a state hospital, Camarillo, for 13 months to be observed. And they loved what they seen because they kept me there for 13 months. And what they observed was somebody who was stone cold sober, drifting in and out of insanity. I was either totally isolated or I was totally off in bizarre behavior. They called me Mr. In-Between. There was nothing there. There was no middle of the road for me. Most of the time I was curled up in my room, isolated and scared. And after 12, 13 months, they let me out of there with my same thing that they let a lot of us out, with a little bag of Thorazine. And they told me the same thing that they tell people like me and you, that you aren't going to operate out in society without any type of mood-altering chemical. We'll see you again, Larry. And I lasted 2 months out there. I lasted 2 months, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles over by the Union Station, and I'm being picked up for publicly being intoxicated, a violation of probation, a public nuisance. Finally made it. Public nuisance. That's what I get to shoot for. And they put me away in the county jail over there called Wayside, and I'm in Wayside for about a month. I'm in Wayside for about a month, and they take about 300 of us over to the Torrance Courthouse, and they're going to transfer us where we're going to go to our penitentiaries to stay the rest of our stay. And they said, 50 guys, and you're going to Mariloma. They name off 50, and you're going to Chino. They name off 50 more, and you're going to Tehachapi. Larry Thomas, you're going to AA. AA? What the hell? Where's AA land? I never heard of AA, you know. AA? You know, what's an AA, you know? And there's a Scottish man with a patch standing outside that jail cell. And he says, "Aye, lad." He says, "My name is Alex." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Come with me. You're going to AA." And I'm not locked up. I'm not chained with anybody, and I'm not in a black and white car. I'm in a lime green Plymouth with a Scottish pirate, and he takes me to my... I'm thinking I'm ready for about a three-hour drive or something. He takes me 6 blocks away from the county jail to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. He takes me over to the Torrance Lamita Alano Club. And I've never seen that word before in my... Alano? What the hell is an Alano Club? Sounds like a Samoan bar. Alano Club, you know? And he takes me over to the Torrance Lamita Alano Club, and he introduced me to a little lady named Indian Jeannie, and Captain Bob, and Singin' Sam, and Tennessee Bill, and Santa Claus Ray, and Bicycle Ray, and a little lady named Moose. And I says, "What the hell am I doing here, man?" Everybody's got a nickname and a tattoo, you know. What the hell's going on here, you know? Little Moose was from Louisiana, and she come running down the hall with me. I mean, she goes, "Hi, my name is Moose." She says, "I'm expecting a miracle." You know, I said, "I bet you are, man." I sure in the hell ain't it, Moose. Believe me, you know. And then this big transvestite comes circling around me, you know, and he's got his hands on my shoulders, which is always dangerous, you know. And he says, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so, man." No. Not for that first year anyway, you know. My God. You know. Let me get on my feet. I know you've got the magic of the program, but, you know, just hold on there, Tiger, you know. And, man, I took one look around that room, and I said, if that's Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't want no part of this, man. And if that's the effect of this little blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in this mess, you know. And I was immediately different, which doesn't take me long. Doesn't take me long at all. And I left those rooms. And from 1975 to 1982, I came out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk. 90 days and get drunk. 60 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. And I wonder why I wasn't having a spiritual experience. And every time I came out of those rooms... And every time I came back, I was desperate. And every time I came back, I wanted not to drink. But the biggest lie that I've ever told myself was that I was coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the biggest lie I ever told myself. I hadn't touched AA. I hadn't brushed shoulders with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting in a room for an hour and a half and leaving. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I never once picked up an ashtray. I never once got a sponsor. I never once conceded to my innermost self by looking at my own life without blaming anybody that, I'm an alcoholic, and drunk or sober, I can't live. And that I never once conceded to my innermost self. I never once applied these steps to my life. I never once told a man my secrets. I never once paid the money back, which is what that step means. They want the dough. They want it. They want it. They want the dough, you know. I never once did what you people did. And I never once had what you people had. And I told myself I was going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't touched AA. I hadn't breathed Alcoholics Anonymous. I come here and I got the heat off. I get physically sober and boom. Feeling okay. Boy, did I make a big deal out of that last drunk. I'm feeling all right, man. Jesus Christ, man. It'll be a cold day in hell before I have... Singin' Sam tell me what to do. Or Tennessee Bill. Man, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to get my life together. Well, you want to see hell. watch an alky who ain't drinking with no program get his life together. We will produce it. We will produce confusion beyond belief, man. Our life will get so unattainable, we will have to drink just to preserve our sanity. Every time, man. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous would come and get me. Every time I called, you people would come and get me. And there never was once a man that come and got me and said, well, you've been here before. I can't get you. Well, you robbed the Hawthorne Alano Club. Or you used us. You threw a cup at that last speaker. They never once said that. Never once said that. Every time they come and got me, man. Every time they come and got me, they said what they tell you today. Are you ready to stop drinking? You want to go to a meeting? How'd you like to learn how to live? They never once questioned me. They never once questioned my heritage. They never once questioned my sex life, where I was from, what county I was from, what race I was. They never once questioned that. Because our common welfare comes first. You being an alcoholic and me being an alcoholic is why I'm here today. You people have been the only ones to touch me. People have been the only ones I could let in. And I don't want to be let out again. I don't want to be cut loose again. I don't ever want to lose what we have here tonight. And that's why I'm responsible. I'm responsible to put out my hand to that new man. Regardless of anybody else's, I've got a responsibility to hear. It's up to me and people like you to keep Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. It ain't up to hospitals, the government, the state. It's up to alkies to keep Alcoholics Anonymous. Not to be wonderful, not to get into heaven, just so we don't gotta be new again. I'll do whatever it takes not to be new again. God, I don't want to be new again. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And in 1980, I'm over at the Don Hotel in Wilmington, California, which isn't much to shoot for. I'm at the third floor of this hotel, and it's the type of hotels we wind up in where you share a bathroom with the whole entire hotel, you know. And you're eating the fish of the day, which is sardines and mustard sauce, you know. And you need your vitamins, and fish is brain food. And there you are with your 69-cent sardines and your cheap wine, and boy, ain't you living, you know. And I've got the two most important things in my room. I've got a hot TV and a hot plate. I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. I've got my lawn chair, and I'm watching my TV show. It's a Thursday morning. It's 10 in the morning. I got my PM bourbon bottle cut in half, and I hear this. Oh, my God, who the hell's that? It must be the landlord. Larry, it's Don. Oh, man, it's that guy from AA, man. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here now, you know. And he opened up the door, and he says, oh, man, what's going on, Larry? You had 15 days. You had 15 days. You were going to be a janitor. There's some hope for you new guys. He says, what the heck's going on? What's going on with you, Larry? And I told Don with all the sincerity that I could muster it up. I took a shot off of that PM bourbon bottle, and I told him with all the sincerity. I said, Don, I said, you've been trying real hard. I started feeling sorry for this guy. I started feeling sorry for this guy because I wasn't staying sober. I thought I was letting him down. I thought I was letting him down, you know? And little did I know that you people were going to teach me the most paradoxical lesson of Alcoholics Anonymous, that man wasn't coming to see me so much because I was an alcoholic. He was coming to see me because he was an alcoholic. He was there to drop off the message. He was there to drop off the message. What I did with it was none of his business. But you can bet your bottom dollar, when he was looking at me, he wasn't worried about his phone bill. He wasn't worried about the tough day he had at work. He was thinking like we're thinking now. Thank God I'm in AA, and thank God I'm sober. I'm glad I ain't that kid in that lawn chair. And you know, I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle, and I told Don with all the sincerity that I could muster up. I said, Don, I said, I don't want what you people have. I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do. The cry of this alcoholic for 30 years, let me do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee in Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll be a cold day in hell before I clean up a room in Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll be a cold day in hell before I have one of these people in AA tell me what to do with my life. It'll be a cold day in hell before I ever come to a room and listen to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll be a cold day in hell. And if you knew, I'd pray for that cold day in hell. I hope you're down so low that Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in your life looks like a step up. Because that was my secret. That no matter how physically bad that I was getting, no matter how physically torn up I was getting and how mentally destroyed I was getting, no matter what the bottom was, I would come to these rooms and secretly feel that I was a little bit better. And for the first time in my life, man, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I come back and you people were a step up. And all that went by my mind in about 15 seconds when the only answer to life I've ever had left my room, that bald-headed carpenter. He left my room, and if you're new and you're having trouble staying, you may leave us, but we'll never leave you. Because somehow, someday, when you least expect it, you're going to be out in your car and you're going to cap the seal off that Muscatel bottle and you're going to think about that alky with the tie on. Or you're going to think about that horny lady who did open the meeting. I know I will. And good or bad, you're going to think about somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous because the seed's been planted. And if you're not alky, don't worry about it. It's only planted in alkies. It's only planted in alkies. And that man planted that seed, and no matter where I was, I'd spend all day to hustle up some dough, and I'd cap the seal off that Muscatel bottle, and there's Don. I went, my God, I didn't think about this guy that much when he was sponsoring me, man. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm living a living hell where I can't get off the streets of Los Angeles, and I can't live, and I can't get die, and I don't want to get off the streets of alcohol of Los Angeles, and I start mission hopping. And on May 1st, 1982, I'm down at the Beacon Light Mission in Wilmington, and I go by a Woolworth window, and I see a vision of myself. I see myself in that window like we've always seen ourselves, and I can't deny what I see. I see myself with my long hair and my rented clothes, and I look at myself and I said, my God, what happened in my dreams? All I wanted to be was a cameraman. Why am I always sobering up and why am I always getting drunk? What the hell's going on with me? And I hustled up some dough and I did what I always do when I get that way. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called the central office down there in Los Angeles, and who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm down at the Beacon Light Mission. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no, you little son of a bitch. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober, he says, you get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you. He says, the sign says we care. It doesn't say we're going to take care of you. And he hung up. I said, my God, that guy used to be so nice, man, you know. What the hell's going on, you know? What happened to all this love and unity, you know? And I took the longest walk of my life. I took the longest walk from Wilmington to Torrance that day, which is a total of 12 miles. And I walked into that room, and I shook it out with the drunks, and I puked it out with the drunks, and I hallucinated with the drunks. And for the first time in my life, I stood up that Thursday night meeting, and I said, my name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I wanted to stay sober, because there was one thing I couldn't deny. While I was going in and out of those rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what your nickname was, and no matter what you look like, I prayed God that I could work these steps and not look like you. And now I blend right in, you know. But that wasn't my worst drunk, and that wasn't my longest drunk. But it was the drunk that drunk away the debate of whether I belong in AA or not. The debate was gone. Or whether or not these things would work, whether or not how long I should, the debate of whether I should stay or not was gone. I come in for the first time in my life, I wanted what you people had, because there was one thing I couldn't deny, that while I was coming in and out of these rooms, you were staying sober. As goofy as you looked, you were staying sober. And I wanted that. I wanted to stay sober. And I want that today. Above all, I don't want to be in here to swim to the beach. I don't want to go back to Newark. I want to stay sober. Then I can swim to the beach and go to Newark. But above all, my primary purpose is to stay sober and not to be new again. I'll do whatever it takes not to be new again. I'll go through Newark to Daytona. I'll talk to Fred. I'll do whatever it takes not to be new. And I come back to you people, and I know I got to wrap this thing up, and I hope I can, because I come back in 1980... come back to the rooms, and for the first 2 years I got that sandbox AA where you know all about the stuff, you know the book, and you know the basics, and somewhere around a year and a half, 2 years sober, you start getting crisp. You start getting real crisp and sarcastic, and your anger's right there again, and you start fantasizing about guns and, you know, who to kill or how should you kill yourself, you know, and oh God, is he speaking, and people around you, life in AA are flourishing, everybody's life's getting better, and you've had it. You've conned yourself for 2 years and it ain't working, Larry. It just ain't working. And at 2 years sober, the man come to my room who's my sponsor today, and he spoke at that meeting, and he told me what I was in front of all those people in that club. He says, Larry, he says, you're a taker still. You're a taker of people. You're a user of things. You'll always be a loser. And he talked to me about an invisible line that we cross in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, there's one to get here when you're drinking out there, you cross an invisible one. He said, but there's another one you have to cross once you stay in AA, and that's from being a taker to a giver. My sponsor, Johnny, he told me in front of that room, he says, you're a taker. And he says, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous called Unity, Service, and Recovery, young man. He says, but there's another triangle. And he says, I pray God you find it. And I followed that man. And that man's my sponsor today. His name is Johnny, and my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And those are the two most important things in my life, not because of who they are, because of what they've done for me. They've shown me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in its entirety. You showed me about the triangle of home, work, and play. And if you're new, I guarantee you that what I do in between meetings is going to constitute whether I stay sober just as much as what I do here tonight. What I do when I'm away from you and how I conduct myself out there has everything to do with my behavior and me staying sober. How I am when I'm at work. How I am when I'm on the freeway. How I am with the public when I'm away from you. And you people taught me how to do that. You taught me that if I can respect the coffee pot and be a good cookie lady, that maybe I won't bite off the head of the grocery clerk. That I don't have to hit and yell at women no more. That I don't have to walk around with that chip on my shoulder. And I followed that man. And I worked the steps with that man. And I did those amends with that man. And I took my mom and sat her down in a room. I took my mom and I sat her down in a room because in 1972, when the macho man was coming out of prison, he had no place to go. And where do macho men go when there's no place to go? They go to mom's house. And the macho man is on the couch, and mom's, I'm wrestling up, and I'm looking for my old Crow bottle, and I can't find it. I make enough noise to have my mom come down the hallway, and she says, honey, what's wrong? I said, don't you, honey, what's wrong with me? And I start smacking around my mom till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with the bottle that I know she took, that I find out when it's in the trash can when I wake up. And I sat down with that lady, and I made amends, like the men in here told me how to make amends to a mother. And she no longer hugs me this way. She puts her arms around me, and she says that she loves me. I want to talk to you about a father that I never knew. I want to talk to you about a dad who's my best friend. Because all he's ever taught me for me is what the men in Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me today. How to go out there and have a job and be a man and be accounted for and be a good person. And I got to make amends to that man. And we're good today. We're current today. I love my life today. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have amends to make. There's a family to take care of. Don't worry about running out and making amends to your dope dealer. You got a family. You got people that you've hurt for 30 years. There was people that I trampled over looking for that second drink. There was people that I trampled over that I had to make amends to. And those people come first, and they were my family. And you taught me how to get together with my family and get tight and be current with my family. Never repeat those actions. And I did that when I was 2 and 3 years sober. And about 2 years ago, me and my dad are coming out of a coffee shop, and it's not Father's Day and it's not Christmas, but we're coming out of that coffee shop, and the old man puts his arm around me and he says, you know what, kid? He says, I love you. I never heard that before. I waited 40 years to hear that. And I heard it once in Alcoholics Anonymous. I may never hear it again, but I heard it once. The old man said he loved me. Good God Almighty, man, I've been wanting to hear that my entire life. What a feeling that was for the old man to say that to me. What a life I lived to get that, to have that come from my father. I've always wanted his approval. And I want to talk to you about the biggest secret that I ever had. I want to talk to you about being 10 years sober and that can't hold a job in AA. I can't hold a job for over 4 or 5 months, and I wonder why. Because in 1986, I get this divorce. I get this divorce, and I don't know about you, but my resentments fester the room. And I had a resentment about this lady that I was divorcing, and I'm not paying her any money. She may have the kid, but she ain't getting none of my money because I don't have much of it, and she ain't getting none of it. Now, how do you legally keep from paying child support? You stay poor. And what you do when you stay poor is you lose jobs, and you lose that attitude, and you lose the ability to hold a job. And sooner or later, at 10 years sober, I'm feeling the same way about losing jobs as I used to feel about staying sober. I know that it's a matter of time I'm going to lose that job. My self-confidence is shot. I have no self-worth, and I feel like killing myself 10 years sober because I can't even fit in and hold a job. I'm 40 years old, and what the hell am I going to do? What's going on with me? And I lost my last job, and I didn't know what to do, so I went and I talked to Clancy, and I told Clancy what was going on. I said, Clancy, I don't know what the hell is going on. I said, I keep getting these jobs, but I keep losing them. And he says, this is what I want you to do, kid. I want you to go out there, and I want you to find a job, any job. And he says, you show up there, and he gave me some techniques. He says, you show up there and you have a good attitude, even when you feel crappy. You show up there early, and the last thing I want you to say, is there anything I can do for you? I said, Clance, but you don't understand. I said, after 2 or 3 months, I get this attitude, and I just feel so crappy that I quit or I get fired or I steal. And he says, when you start feeling that way, he says, call me in the morning. He says, I'll make you feel so crappy you'll love to go to work. And he was right. He was right. He was right. And I thank God for that moment that I was in that man's office. I thank God for that moment that I sat down with Clancy and he told me that. Because that's exactly what I needed. And I never once confided to another man that that was going on with me. And that's kept me right and that's kept me current. And I love my life today because of that. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? What kind of life are you going to give him? Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They took me out of the gutters and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sakes, you know? And I love my life today. I love my life today. And for the first time in my life, because of a simple 5 minutes in a man's room, I've held my job for the longest I've ever held a job. I've almost held this job for close to 2 years. And I love that. And I'm current with my child support. And when I pick up my little girl, Lauren, who's only 6, 7 years old, I pick her up and she says, Daddy, I love you. And we have a great relationship and she loves Gloria and they get together well. And I love my life today. And there ain't nothing I'll ever do to harm that little girl. Because when I wasn't working, when I was 10 years sober and I wasn't holding that job, there was one thing that happened to me. I went to visit that little girl on child support and I went to pick her up and she had holes in her socks. She had little holes in her underwear. And I'm responsible for that. My not working wasn't just affecting me. My not working was affecting that little girl in her life. I had a responsibility and I was avoiding it. And my little girl was suffering because of my selfishness and self-centeredness. When are you going to get out of yourself and realize what you're doing, Larry, and be responsible for your own actions? And that's not happening today. That's not happening today. And I love my life today. I can hold my head up high in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my little girl comes to me with her problems. She came to me the other day and she told me she's real smart in school. She's like a B and A student. She comes to me and she says, Daddy, she says, I'm having trouble in school. She says, the kids are making fun of me because I'm smart. She says, did you ever have that problem? Seems to me I have, you know. And I told her the God's honest truth. I said, no. I said, but I know what it's like to be on the other side of that. I know what it's like to be on the flip side of that and envy so much somebody you'll make fun of them. I know what it's like to be on the other side of that. And she's a good little girl today. I love my little girl. I love the life I have with Glory, and I love my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I used to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to see these guys go, 30 days ago, I was in the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you, you know. God, I came in with that guy, you know. I used to think Alcoholics Anonymous would shield me from life's little bullets. And what it does, it sticks you smack dab in the middle of life and you better have a program because nobody cares. They don't care. They don't care. You people care. You people care. For 30 years, people have been trying to do something about my attitude and my behavior. And they always started from the head down. They always wanted to change my thinking and my environment and my mentality and stuff like that. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you what AA has done for me. They've trained my feet. They've trained my feet. We want the decent thing that you only have left is your feet. They've trained my feet because while I'm in that shower and I'm saying, I'm not going, I'm not going to go, I'm not going to go. Hi, my name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is the longest thing I've ever done against my will, which is why it works so damn good. It goes totally against my will. And you've trained my feet. You've trained my feet so that after a period of time, it doesn't matter. I just go. I'm trained to do certain things, and my life has gotten better. They say that the longest journey is from the head to the heart. And if you knew, I think there's another journey. Another longer journey is from the head to the feet. You can think about doing stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, but until you start doing it, the effects won't take place. And I pray, God, that you do that. I pray, God, that you're so desperate you do things that you know won't work for you, and may God be with you. But more important than that, I hope you do the things in Alcoholics Anonymous like we've all done the things in Alcoholics Anonymous and find a loving God. A loving God like he's expressed himself here tonight in this room with alcoholics of our type. Thank you very much.